Levy and Stanisław Krajewski.
Thank you. Thank you, Janusz. It's really an immense pleasure to be here with you and with Yossi. Yossi, whom I have known for almost 30 years. And of course, we met in Poland, in Warsaw, but then also we were meeting in Israel. Yossi is a very well-known journalist, basically, and writer. And we'll be talking here about the book, which is called Like Dreamers, as you may know, which is the story of the Israeli paratroopers who reunited Jerusalem and divided a nation, or that nation. Now, Yossi has written other books. Let me mention one of those other books, which to me is immensely important, namely the book which has the telling title At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, which is, I would be happy if we could talk about that book too, but I don't think there is time for the two topics which are completely different. Although probably whatever you write is like trying to be, to have a look at the Garden of Eden in some ways, or to see how people look at the Garden of Eden. Before we begin, there is a certain request of Yossi, namely, Yossi has today Yahrzeit, and so, and there was no other opportunity for him to say Kaddish, so maybe we can do it right now. Is that
sure
the idea? Okay.
So first of all, I'm just really delighted to be here, and Janosz, I apologize, but I really do love Poland, and I've loved Poland since my first trip here in 1989, the fateful year when I met Staszek and Monica and Kostek, and that was basically the Jewish community. And it's really astonishing to me to see what has happened and what's been created here, largely thanks to you, Janosz, and your team, and that you've created a space that brings Jews from around the world back here and to celebrate the life of Jewish culture. So thank you for your vision, for your dream. And today is the anniversary of my father's passing. He died in 1978. He was young, a Holocaust survivor from Transylvania. And so if I could say Kaddish, that would be great. And everyone is welcome, whether you're Jewish or not, to say Amen. So. יתקדל ויתקדש שמי רבה. בילמד יברך ירותי וימליך מחותי בחיי חון ובימי חון ובחיי דכל בית ישראל בגלה וזמן קריב ואמרו אמן. יהי שמי רבה מברך לעולם עולמי עלמיה. יתברך וישתבח ויתפאר ויתרומם ויתנשא ויתאדר ויתעלה ויתעלה שמי דקודשה בריחו. לילה מן כל בחתה ושירתה תושבחתה ונחמתה דמירן בילמה ואמרו אמן. יהי שלמה רבה מן שמיה וחיים עלינו והכל ישראל ואמרו אמן. עושה שלום במרומיו הוא יעשה שלום עלינו ועל כל ישראל ועל כל יושבי תבל ואמרו אמן.
אמן.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's an unusual, but maybe very proper way of beginning. So the book is, we'll say something about the book, but let me first perhaps ask you about your own relation to Jerusalem. So how did it develop over those decades, you know, from your Brooklyn childhood?
Well, my first visit to Jerusalem happened when I was 14, and it was late June 1967. It was about 3 weeks after the Six-Day War, And my father, who had two brothers who had survived the war and were living in Israel, and whom he had not seen since the war, immediately after the Six-Day War said, "That's it, we're getting on a plane," and he couldn't keep away any longer. And in those years, you know, travel, airplane travel was quite unusual, not only from the Soviet bloc, but even from the United States. You didn't just get on a plane and go to Israel. And that summer, much of the diaspora converged on Israel. And there really was this sense of wanting to touch something of the radiance of Israel. We just had to be there. And so my relationship with Jerusalem, with Israel, really begins at the peak moment, the moment of euphoria. And that summer of 1967 was a very strange time in retrospect, because Israelis believed that the wars were over, that we had come to the end of Jewish history. You remember Fukuyama's essay in 1989, "The End of History"? Well, 1967 was the end of Jewish history, and we were the generation that was privileged to be the victors. And so I experienced the summer of 67 in this sense of it's over and we won. And maybe I'll just add one more just brief story about my father that summer. And my father came out of the Shoah refusing to pray. And it was a very Jewish response to the Shoah, because it's not that he stopped believing in God. My father always believed in God. But precisely because he believed in God, he refused to pray to him, because God was God and God could have stopped the Holocaust and didn't. So God didn't deserve Jewish prayer. A very Jewish way of navigating the relationship with God. And in the summer of 1967 at the wall, and I was with him, I saw this happen, he became a practicing Jew again. And he started to pray again, and he said, "Now I can forgive God." So when I think about my relationship to Jerusalem, it really starts from that moment, the moment of the end of exile and the end of mourning. And then what happens over the next decades for me is, as for I think the rest of the Jewish people, is coming down from Mount Sinai back into reality. And the reality is sometimes very painful. And we got a glimpse in the summer of 67 into what it could be like, what the Jewish people should be like, but we're not that way now.
Okay, and then you came to Israel, you settled in Israel at some point, and in Jerusalem. Yeah. Did you think that Jerusalem is the place, or that there could be other places in Israel too?
It's funny, Sarah and I moved to Israel in 1982, and we moved to Jerusalem. There never was a question of living anywhere else. It was, and I think for the same reason, when I asked myself why I moved to Israel, and the answer for me is very straightforward, because it's possible. I live in a generation where it is possible to fulfill that, to actually live in a Jewish state. And if it's possible for me to live in Israel, and it's possible to live in Jerusalem, then I just didn't see any other alternative. I think that if we were moving to Israel today, I have a feeling that we would be examining other options. Jerusalem's a very hard place to be. It's I'm a lover of Jerusalem. I feel grateful for being there, but it's a constant strain to live with that level of hostility both between Palestinians and Israelis, and I feel it every day. I ride the new light rail train in Jerusalem, which isn't so new anymore, but we in Jerusalem you think of millennia, and so 10-15 years is new. And on the train you have Palestinians, Israelis, Haredim, ultra-Orthodox, secular Russians, and in one way I like it very much because everyone is forced into that intimacy, that kind of unwanted intimacy on the light rail train. On the other hand, you really feel the tension of people avoiding eye contact, and of course every Jew on the train is always thinking, who is it going to be and when will it happen and how will I react if someone pulls out a knife? So that's just between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And then you factor in the ultra-Orthodox, non-ultra-Orthodox tensions. And so Jerusalem is many volcanoes.
Yes, in the book, there are very detailed and fascinating descriptions of the battles, and especially that battle 50 years ago, almost exactly 50 years ago, that reunited Jerusalem. But to make it clear, you know, for those who haven't read the book, this is a book not just about the battles or about history. It's a book about several individuals, paratroopers who were in that elite unit and were in very important in that moment, and then their lives after that, and their different and sometimes opposing ideological and religious options. And so the book is really about Jewish ideologies, I would say, and about how different they are, and how difficult it is to have the right one, so to say. So that one of the most wonderful things about this book is that you never judge. You present everyone from the very right wing to the very far left, objectively, with full sympathy, and I find it's absolutely admirable, this acceptance. Still, I would ask the question whether among those seven main characters there is one whom you feel the closest. To be the closest. I have my guess, but I would like you to answer if you want.
Well, Stashek, maybe before I answer, I would like to say something about the way the book was written and why.
Good idea. Sure.
So the book focuses on seven characters, three of them religious Zionists who go on to become founders of the West Bank settlement movement, and four secular kibbutzniks who go on to become identified with the peace movement, the anti-settlement movement, seven friends who fought together in 67, in 73, in 1982 in the Lebanon War, and who fought with each other as civilians. And the way that I tried to tell this story is by when I'm writing, let's say, about a settler, the point of view of the book is right wing. When I switch to one of the kibbutzniks, the point of view of the book is left wing. And it's happening inside the state of consciousness of each of these characters. And the reason that I wanted to do it that way is, I'd say, twofold. One is because I wanted to disorient the reader. and that whatever camp you're from, to force you into the state of consciousness of your political rival. That camp that you believe is dangerous for Israel, whether you come from the left or the right. And the other reason is that I feel that we as a people are losing our story. We're losing our ability to tell our story. And this is making us very vulnerable to those enemies of the Jewish people who have a very clear idea what the Jewish story represents, which is this is a story about evil. Zionism is a story about evil. And one reason that I think we're losing our ability to tell our story is because we are so deeply torn about what this story means. So up until the Six-Day War, most Jews, I think, really had a basic consensus about what the state of Israel means, and that this was a blessing to the Jewish people. Immediately after the Six-Day War, two camps emerge. One believes that the Six-Day War is the greatest blessing in the history of the state of Israel, and maybe one of the greatest blessings in the history of the Jewish people, and the consequences of the Six-Day War, the return to Judea and Samaria, the ability to reclaim the biblical heartland, is one of the greatest events to ever happen to the Jewish people. And you have another group that's within the Jewish people that sees this as the greatest curse that has happened to the state of Israel. And so if we can't agree in the most minimal way about what our story means, we are losing our story. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, my definition, and maybe this is a writer's definition, but my definition of who the Jews are is that we are a story that we tell ourselves about who we think we are. Which is why the Seder is our most important ritual. Who we are, which is why we're a people that is addicted to storytelling. And so who we are and what our story means is the essence of our being. And we're losing that now.
Okay, so maybe we can, before we come back to my original question, we can talk about those two stories, narratives. So one is and in fact also about those two elites, you know, the kibbutznik elite and the settler elite, and ideologies, the two ideologies or two Zionisms, as you at some point put it. So the first is the kibbutzniks. So what is really the ideology of kibbutzniks? You know, this is pretty well known, but I think it's worth repeating or maybe summarizing. What they wanted for themselves, for the Jews, and for the world.
I think the genius of the early kibbutzniks was to take classical Jewish messianism, religious messianism, and to transform it into a serious Jewish idea of the future state of Israel as being the laboratory for democratic communism. That the first genuine voluntary communism on a mass basis was going to happen in the state of Israel. And when you read the early kibbutzniks, the early theoreticians, I mean, you have the embarrassing analogies between Stalin and Isaiah, you know, that's there. But the deeper expression, and you see it from Ben-Gurion especially, is that the dream of that when Jews imagined that what would happen when we would one day return home, it would not only transform the Jewish people, it would change the world. And it would happen through social justice and through this society that would be created on the model of the kibbutz. And the kibbutz never saw itself as a small experiment. It was the nucleus of how the state of Israel, the future state, would be formed. Now, it didn't happen that way. And gradually the kibbutz movement starts to lose its passion, its ideology. And 1967 is really the catalyst. It's the moment of the changing of the guard. And nobody realized that at the time, that the religious Zionists who are coming with a much more classical idea of messianism, that the return of the Jewish people home will bring, literally trigger the messianic era, bring the Messiah. But that group becomes energized as a result of the Six-Day War and the return to the biblical lands and the settlement movement that emerges from this messianic vision. So one messianic vision, the secular messianic vision of the kibbutz, is starting to decline, and the religious messianic vision is rising.
But before we come to the other one, you know, you in your book, you know, there's a very good description of this, you know, disillusionment of the and the quasi-religious quality of the kibbutz ideology. Ideologues became, you know, less and less viable and sort of almost disappeared. My question is, from your present-day perspective, how much of the kibbutznik ideas, kibbutz ideas, and how much of the kibbutzim as the factor in Israeli life, how much has remained? How important is it? Just a remnant or something more? What do you feel?
The kibbutz as kibbutz more or less belongs to history. But the spirit of the kibbutz is integral to the Israeli ethos. And we saw that emerge in 2011, where it was anyone here in Israel when the tent camp was created on Rothschild Boulevard? Now that was an extraordinary moment where Israel's most prestigious, Tel Aviv's most prestigious boulevard is turned into a protest tent camp with the municipality actually providing services. And it went on for 2 months. And hundreds of thousands of Israelis were involved in this movement. And there was something that I loved going there. I loved just walking around the tent camp because I felt that there was something of the old Israel that these young people were expressing. The songs that they were singing were the old songs. And one of my friends, Avital Geva, who's one of the kibbutznikim from the book, used to go there constantly and just walk and talk to the young people and feel that here something is happening again, something of the old spirit. So and then that faded away as well. But I think there is a deep part of the Israeli DNA is that there's something wrong if Israel really is not striving for justice. There's something we are failing ourselves. We're failing Zionism if we're not holding ourselves up to higher standards, and that comes, I think, in large part from the kibbutz.
Mm-hmm. So, and kibbutzim exist. I mean, and some of them do quite well.
Yes.
But they are not the models or the...
Well, it's interesting because the more wealthy a kibbutz, the more socialist they've remained. And because they can afford to be socialist. And the other kibbutzim, and there are about a quarter of the kibbutzim that are what we now call in Israel traditional kibbutzim, which is a very funny term for a revolutionary movement, nevertheless. The traditional kibbutzim are mostly those that are economically successful, and the less economically successful have become privatized.
And now we have this other group, and which really emerged only then, in 67, but of course it has roots which are much older. So the settlers, they began certainly with the ideas of the old Rabbi Cook, and then the cooks Yehuda Tzvi Cook and his center Merkaz, and You know, for me, kibbutzim is a rather well-known story, and I think for many of those present here. But to know from inside the story of the settlers, this was something that I got from your book, and I'm very grateful for that. It shows a similar idealism and similar selflessness, and of course, you know, determination. And so the question is, you know, how maybe you can say something about this Merkaz and also how it evolved and how it changed and what has remained, I mean, of those initial idealist settler ideologues.
So I called the book Like Dreamers partly because the book deals with the fate of Israel's utopian dreams. And the kibbutz movement is, as you say, it's that story is well known. The settlement movement and religious Zionism is a story that's known only very superficially. And it's strange because if you think of let's say in our generation, Israel equaled kibbutz in the imagination of the world. Kibbutz was a symbol, the symbol of Israel. Today, for better or for worse, the symbol of Israel for much of the world is settlement. And yet the settlement movement is not at all understood. And so when I discovered that the founders of the settlement movement and some of the leaders of the peace movement had served together and fought together in the battle for Jerusalem, I felt this is really the way that I could tell this story.
And some of them remained friends.
Yes, very much so. The closest friendships in the book are across political lines. And the strongest rivalries are within each camp. So maybe that's a familiar story to ideological movements. But the settlement movement begins in September 1967, just before Rosh Hashanah, and we're about to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the settlement movement. Now, the 50th anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem was a pretty uneventful and harmonious event in Israel. In a few months from now, the 50th anniversary of the settlement movement, I think, will be much more controversial. But what was so interesting for me when I began studying this and researching this was to, first of all, to realize that the first settlement was actually a kibbutz. The first settlement was founded in Kfar Etzion, in the area we call the Etzion Block, about 20 minutes or 25 minutes south of Jerusalem, just past Bethlehem, between Bethlehem and Hebron. And It was built as on the site of a community, a kibbutz that had been destroyed, literally on the eve of Israel's founding. On May 13th, 1948, kibbutz Kfar Etzion was destroyed, its defenders surrendered, and they were massacred. So this was one of the most traumatic memories in the history of the state. And so the founding of the first settlement happened with complete consensus in Israel, from left to center to right. In fact, there was no debate about the founding of Kfar Etzion. There wasn't even a cabinet meeting. The children of Kfar Etzion, who had been evacuated before the fall in 1948, met with Prime Minister Levi Eshkol and said to him, "We'd like to go back and reestablish our place and pray on Rosh Hashanah." And Eshkol, who loved to speak Yiddish more than Hebrew, said to them, "Nu kindelach, new children, go back, you can go and pray." And that's how the first settlement was founded. But I'm mentioning Kfar Etzion as well because it was a kibbutz. And it was a kind of a missing link between the pioneering movement of the kibbutz and then the settlement movement, which saw itself, even though the kibbutzim didn't see them that way, but they saw themselves as the next stage of pioneering Zionism. And if I could just say one...
But the Kfar Etzion, the re-established kibbutz, was religious from the very beginning, clear for...
It was a religious kibbutz in the 40s as well. Now, what's also interesting is that the second settlement that's founded, 6 months later, in Hebron, on Pesach, Passover, 1968. And there again, the founding of the Jewish community in Hebron is the reestablishment of a Jewish community that had been destroyed in the living memory of many Israelis. And so the first two settlements were not built just out of longing of ancient biblical connection and to reestablish the glory of biblical times, but they were built, they were reconstructed communities that had been destroyed in modern times. And I think that's very important for understanding the significance of the settlement movement and why, at least initially, it had very strong support.
Okay, and then what was happening later? I mean, I found it with some surprise that it took quite a lot of time for them to really begin real settler activities.
Yes, the labor governments, and don't forget that Israel, it wasn't only Poland that was a one-party system until 1989. The State of Israel was a one-party system. We had many parties. We had 50 parties, but we were a one-party system. We were governed by the Labor Party uninterrupted until 1977. And in those years, between 1967 and 1977, the Labor Party put a very strict lid on settlement activity. The Labor Party had a very clear idea of where settlements should happen and where they shouldn't happen. And there was a great deal of frustration from the young religious Zionist messianic community. And until the Yom Kippur War of 1973, there was very little settlement activity. And in fact, the settlement movement was not organized at all in those years. The Labor Party was much more than a party. It was the founding party of the State of Israel. It was the party that had won the Six-Day War. It was mythic. Moshe Dayan was a demigod in the State of Israel until the Yom Kippur War. And the failure, at least in the first days, Israel's failure initially in the Yom Kippur War, shatters the trust of the Israeli public in the Labor Party. And that's the moment when the messianic religious Zionists feel this is now our time, because labor Zionism has failed. It has lost its self-confidence. It's lost the confidence of the people. And it's losing its Zionist fervor. And this is the moment where the religious Zionists have to come in and take control from the secular Zionists who are losing their Zionism. And the turning point, the moment where the religious Zionist settlement movement called Gush Emunim, the Block of the Faithful, the moment where they defeat the labor government, it's a very specific moment. It happens in late November 1975, Chanukah 1975, when thousands of mostly young religious Zionists, led by Naomi Shemer, the great Israeli composer, she had composed Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold, which was almost a second anthem, former kibbutznik, and she leads this march of thousands of young people to an abandoned Turkish railway station, an Ottoman-era railway station near Shechem, the West Bank city of Nablus, and the Rabin government freezes. Every other time that the religious Zionists had tried to settle forcibly, the government of Yitzhak Rabin, the first Rabin government, would send the army in and evacuate the settlers, an often violent confrontation. This time the government backs down, And it's the moment when the settlement movement has its breakthrough. And the question that I asked myself when I began this was why? Because I didn't know the story of Sebastia, that was the name of the railway station. Why did the Labour government give in 1975? And the answer was staring me right there in the face. And that was November 9th, 1975, 2 weeks before the big demonstration, the UN voted to equate Zionism with racism. It was a Soviet initiative with the Muslim states and the communist bloc. And this moment changes Israeli society. The rage among Israelis against the international community begins then. And the backlash among Israelis was, okay, if the UN is saying that we are thieves in the land of Israel, that none of this belongs to us, then we're going to go with these crazy religious kids, and we're going to support. It's all of it is ours. And you see, reading the Israeli newspapers of those weeks, reading the op-ed pages, you see left-wing columnists writing, "I never supported this movement, but maybe it's time for us to tell the UN a Zionist message." And so the reason that I'm telling you this story, and the reason I feel it's such an important story, is because it tells us something essential about Israel's relationship with the international community. When Israelis feel that we are being treated fairly, there is an openness, a willingness to take risks for peace. The Oslo peace process begins in 1993 with the fall of the Soviet Union, when the Eastern Bloc renews diplomatic relations with Israel. India, China, the Vatican all renew relations, establish relations with Israel. And so Israelis feel that the international community is treating Israel fairly, and we can begin to explore the possibilities of taking a risk for peace. But when we feel that we're under siege, that we're being boycotted or demonized, then the primary beneficiary politically in Israel is the hard right. And that's the dynamic, and we're seeing it happen especially now.
Also, that UN resolution was also on the day, or almost on the day, of the anniversary of the Kristallnacht, in addition to everything else.
It was the next day, exactly.
So it was really very powerful symbolically. Okay, coming back to the characters. So each of them is an interesting character. And is there one that you find yourself closest to?
Well, I would say that yes, and I will reluctantly name him, but for me, I divide these characters into two camps that are not necessarily left and right, kibbutzniks and settlers. There's the camp of those Israelis among these characters who evolve with the years, who grow, whose ideas are challenged by reality, whether they come from the right or from the left, and you see them struggling and changing. That's one camp. The second camp are those who don't grow. The reader encounters them when they're 22 years old in 1967, and they have their clear left-wing or right-wing ideas, and that's who they remain in their 60s and 70s. And for me, the heroes of the book are those who change. And within that camp, I have three people in particular who I love, and if you'll force me to choose one, I will. But I'd prefer to name the three because they're all really, I think, tremendous characters. The first is Arik Ahmon, kibbutznik, former kibbutznik, who is the in the Six-Day War is the chief intelligence officer of the paratrooper brigade that fights in Jerusalem. In 1973, he is the senior officer that leads the crossing of the Suez Canal, which wins the war against Egypt. So he is a kind of a mythic military figure. But more to the point, in terms of his evolution, he goes on to become the CEO of Arkia, which is Israel's domestic airline. And he becomes the first privatizer of a government company. So he is one of the fathers of the modern post-socialist Israeli economy. And this is a kibbutznik, a former kibbutznik. And he is married to the daughter of the legendary leader of the kibbutz movement. And so for Arik Achmon to go against socialist Israel and to say, you know, it was great for its time, but we're in a new era. We need a different economy. That for me makes him really, in some ways, the hero of the book. I would also mention Yoel Binun, Rabbi Yoel Binun, who is one of the founders of Gush Emunim, the religious messianic settlement movement. And after the Rabin assassination, Rabbi Binun turns against his fellow rabbis in the settlement movement, accuses them of helping create the atmosphere leading to Rabin's assassination, and becomes an outcast in his movement. He has to leave the settlement that he helps found, Ofra. And I think that what he did in publicly breaking ranks after the Rabin assassination was help save Israel from civil war. Because the fact that one of the leaders of the settlement movement, somebody with tremendous spiritual authority, took the side of the left after the Rabin assassination, helped blur the borders, the political distinctions, and helped confuse the political map, and helped save us, I think, from civil war. And maybe the last person I'll mention is the person who would be the last character to think of himself as a hero, and that's Meir Ariel. Meir Ariel was the Israeli Bob Dylan. He died in 1999, the only one of the characters I didn't know. And Meir really is one of our most beloved poet troubadours. Every year around the anniversary of his death, thousands of Israelis gather. The leading Israeli singers, bands, sing songs, and this just grows from year to year. The love that Israelis feel for Meir. And what makes Meir so special for me, besides his extraordinary music and poetry, is that he begins as a kind of a typical secular kibbutznik, and he dies as a deeply religious Jew who would sit every morning for hours in talit and tefillin, and that's how he composed through the morning. And Meir is one of those figures that I see as a connection between secular Israel, the Israel of the kibbutz, and the Israel that is emerging now.
Yes, that's very interesting. And all those characters come out very strongly and very clearly when you read the book. So I'm really so grateful to you for this.
Thank you.
And I thought about Yoel Binun as the person who is in some way, you know, because, you know, one is a businessman, the first. The third is a singer. So it's not so much yours or mine, for that matter, métier. But Yoel Binun is a rabbi, and really a person who tries to find the right, I don't know, ways, and propose the right ways for others. And I was really struck by some of the statements, or by maybe his opinions that you describe as his. So, for example, that he considered all Jews as being, he was against this division between religious and non-religious Jews, but rather that all are observant to some degree, some more, some less. And that I found very interesting and very, you know, it's similar with Mayor Ariel also, yes, in some ways.
He has a great expression about his friend Avital Geva, the kibbutznik, where he says, Avital doesn't need to wear a kippah because the heavens are his kippah.
That's it. And also that he was so, being a settler, a leader of the settlers, he was very pro-state. That is, he thought that the state is such a great value that to oppose the state, the government, the official government policies is wrong, because that would undermine the state as such, and that would be a disaster. And he was very consistent with that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's also very interesting. And my question is, how much of that, respect for the state as the state is present among the, I don't know, right-wing settler, I don't know, community?
I think we've had a few significant moments of testing where the religious Zionist community was called on to choose between loyalty to its ideology, loyalty to the settlements, loyalty to their rabbis, or loyalty to the democratic institutions of the state. And I'm thinking, first of all, of the withdrawal from Sinai in 1982, when the government of Menachem Begin uprooted settlements in the Sinai Desert. And then in 2005, when the government of Prime Minister Sharon uprooted the settlements in Gaza. And it was an open question of whether religious Zionists would respond violently, because these were their communities that the government was destroying. And even more to the point, whether religious soldiers would follow the commands to participate in the evacuation of settlers. And you saw a tremendous struggle happening in the months before in the army. And I was working in those years as a journalist, and I covered this. And I would go to meetings that the army educational corps would convene, where they would have conversations about the ethics of following orders. When do you follow orders? When do you not follow orders? And I was at one meeting where a religious Zionist general, the first Elazar Stern, he's a Knesset member today, the first religious general, spoke to a group of religious recruits, and he said to them, there's no such thing as you not fulfilling an order to evacuate settlements because it will interfere with your conscience. And he said to them, I have friends on the left who hate the settlements, who believe that the settlements should not be there. But every time they're called upon in reserve duty to defend the settlements, they go and they're ready to risk their lives. If they can risk their lives to defend settlements, you can follow army orders to evacuate settlements. And so I think that when it came down to it, the religious Zionist community did prove that its commitment is to the democratic institutions of the state. Whether that would apply if we evacuate from the West Bank, I don't know. And that's a question I ask myself all the time.
You mentioned that somehow the narratives that have been guiding the Israeli or maybe the Jewish public have been lost, or certainly the kibbutznik ones. The other one has underwent transformations. So can we say that we are back to normalization in a completely non-Zionist sense, namely that those who are real idealists or idealist fanatics are religious or Haredim Jews, and you know, as it has always been, and the whole period of modern Jewish ideologies is over? How do you think?
that's the book has just come out in Hebrew a few weeks ago, and the Israeli publisher asked me to write an epilogue for the Hebrew edition, and the last line of the book is it possible that the great dreams are over, and is it really possible to imagine an Israel without any kind of dream of redemption, religious, secular, social, whatever it is. And that's the question that I end the book with. And if we look at the situation today, the big dreams are over. And this is the first time, not only in the history of the State of Israel, but in the history of Zionism, where there is no avant-garde that has some wild utopian dream and is trying to pull the rest of Zionism, the rest of Israeli society after it. And, you know, there are many ways of telling the Israeli story. And the way that I try to tell it here is through the fate of our big dreams and the move from the kibbutz, the Israel of the kibbutz, to the Israel of the settlement, to Israel of today. Now, obviously, the settlements are still there, but they're not a big idea anymore. The settlements, however one regards their dream, they had a big messianic dream. And you don't see that anymore. If you look at the head of the religious Zionist party in the Knesset, Naftali Bennett, the head of the Jewish Home Party, which is the leading pro-settler party, Naftali Bennett is a politician. He speaks in the name of security. The settlements are important because of security. There's no pretense of a dream. And so, if you can say who won the battle between the kibbutz and the settlement, the answer, at least today, and I'm emphasizing today because what will happen next we can speak about, but today the winner in the battle between the kibbutz and the settlement movement is Tel Aviv. And normalization seems to have won. The problem there is that normalization is a very tricky way of describing Israel, because Israel is a completely abnormal society. It's treated abnormally in the international community. And you know, this notion, the old Zionist dream of normalizing the Jewish people, which is a very touching dream to me, the fact that you can take the most abnormal people in history and make them a normal people by transferring them to a land that is holy to three rival religions in the most abnormal region in the world, the Middle East. And this is where we're going to normalize the Jewish people. It's and the Zionists actually believed that this was possible. And I love the dream of normalization. In fact, I think of normalization as a messianic dream. You know, it's for the Zionists, it was the anti-messianic dream, but to normalize the Jewish people is such a fantasy that I would almost put it in a utopian category. So, but that's where we are now. Still, if you look at what is beginning to happen in Israeli society, I think maybe this is wishful thinking, because this is certainly what I hope is going to happen, but I sense that we are at the beginning of a spiritual awakening in Israeli society, in which more and more Israelis are going to begin to take ownership of their Judaism. Because what happened in Israel is that we imported the Judaism that was created in the ghetto. The Judaism that was created in over 2,000 years of exile and powerlessness. And we brought that same Judaism into conditions of Jewish sovereignty, where it doesn't belong. And we haven't begun thinking about what does it mean to have a sovereign public Jewish space where we are the majority, where the Christians and the Muslims are the minority. This is such a revolutionary transformation in the Jewish condition that we haven't begun thinking of the consequences, not just politically, but more deeply, religiously, spiritually. And I think that Israelis are starting to ask some of these questions now. So that I think the next big utopian dream in Israel is going to be the struggle for Israeli Judaism. And that is going to be a big internal war. It's a war against the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, and the chief rabbinate, and all of those forces that represent the Judaism of the pre-sovereign era. And this may sound paradoxical, but that form of Judaism has allies among many secular Israelis. Because many secular Israelis say, that's the real authentic Judaism. I hate it. I don't want any part of it. But that's the real authentic Judaism. And that kind of strange coalition of the old forms of Judaism with the secularists who have no interest in Judaism but validate that as the only authentic Judaism, that's the struggle.
So, by the way, you are the senior fellow in the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, and I understand the Shalom Hartman Institute is one of those places where such ideas as the new Judaism or Judaism that is relevant to the present day Israel
or Judaism
are being thought of. Yes,
absolutely. And the Hartman Institute is a fascinating place. It was started by the late David Hartman, who was my teacher, my friend, and David Hartman was an Orthodox rabbi who came from North America. He grew up in Brooklyn, was a rabbi in Montreal, and came to Israel and created the Hartman Institute as an attempt to try to broaden Israeli Orthodoxy, to open it up and make it more broad-minded. And Israeli Orthodoxy rejected him. And so he adopted as a kind of an alternative project the need to deepen liberal American Judaism and the Hartman Institute and secular Israel. So that the Hartman Institute has become a place where secular Israelis come to become more Jewish in a modern Israeli way, and where North American, mostly liberal, rabbis from the liberal denominations come to deepen their Judaism. So it's an institute that has its deep roots in the Orthodox community and is playing out in other parts of the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. Are there other centers of that kind that you can...
Very much so. Just to name Bina, which is the... it calls itself a secular yeshiva. It comes out of the kibbutz movement. And as soon as you bring those two concepts together, it's not really secularism anymore. You know, many secular Israelis have a very 19th century idea of secularism and religion. And I'm not sure why that is. Maybe because Zionism comes out of 19th century Europe. But there's really this very rigid way of thinking. And it's not at all postmodern. And so what you're starting to see is some Israelis are beginning to understand that, first of all, science and religion have both moved on, and that there's some very interesting areas. Think of contemporary physics, for example, where there are areas of meeting between mysticism and postmodern physics, and so there are areas of exploration that secular Israel has not been open to in the past and is starting to consider now.
I have one more question about the background of the book. What do you think was the role of the Shoah or the memory of the Shoah in all those developments in the 50 years ago and later? I was really struck by the fact that one of the your heroes, Israel Harel, was hiding his own experience. He is a survivor, and
as a child survivor,
mm-hmm. and then became one of the leaders of the settlers. And he was not talking about that. First of all, why? And second, has it changed since then?
Well, Israel in its early years was a very hard place. It's still hard in certain ways, but it's become much more nuanced, and I think Israeli society today is a lot more pluralistic. I think it's a lot more democratic, despite all of the concerns, which I share as well, about the future of Israeli democracy. It's a lot more democratic than it was. And one of the expressions of that rigidity in the early years of Israeli society was the relationship, the judgmentalness of native-born young Israelis in particular to Holocaust survivors. Holocaust survivors were seen by that first generation of Israelis as failed Jews and failed human beings. They didn't resist. They must have done something criminal in order to survive. They must have betrayed someone along the way. That was the widespread perception in Israel in the 50s and 60s. It was very cruel. The change began with the Eichmann trial in 1961-62, and then it really I would say the turning point, the real turning point, happened with the Yom Kippur War. Because what happened in 1973 is that Israel really experienced, at least in that first week to 10 days, the fear of defeat for the first time. Israelis never really believed that we would be defeated, and in the early days of the Yom Kippur War, we almost were. The road was completely open in the first days to from the Golan Heights to Tiberia, to Tiberias. In the south, there were 50 Israeli tanks against the Egyptian army. And in particular, I happened to have been in Israel that year. I was a student, an overseas student at Hebrew University in 1973. And I remember watching with an Israeli family that I was staying with, watching TV and seeing the images coming through of Israeli prisoners of war from the south, from Sinai, with their arms, their hands behind their heads, and they had chains and padlocks, locks on their wrists, and the shock in the Israeli public of seeing Israeli soldiers, dozens of Israeli soldiers being paraded in front of the cameras. So something of the possibility of vulnerability opens up in the Israeli experience with Yom Kippur. And a result of that was a re-examination of Israeli attitudes towards survivors in particular. Today, survivors are heroes in Israel. They've been for many years. And it's very touching. You see high school students adopting elderly survivors. It's really a part of the culture in a way that was inconceivable in Israel in the 50s and 60s. And one of the aspects of this story, of telling this story, that was so moving for me was seeing how Israel changes. This is a society in active transformation from the moment of its creation, partly because of the wars, partly because of the layers of mass immigration, and each mass immigration completely transforms Israel. And I remember Sarah and I took a sabbatical in 1989, which is when we met you, and I spent that year traveling through Eastern Europe and working as a journalist and reporting on the fall of communism, going from one country to the next. And when we came back to Israel, just before the Gulf War, November 1990, suddenly there are tens of thousands of Russians in the country. And I remember the first time going to the supermarket and seeing Russian letters on the milk and the butter, and it suddenly was a different country. I said, what happened? We were away for a year, and we come back, and it's a new Israel. And so Israel is constantly reinventing itself, and that is, I think, one of the aspects of greatness of the Israeli experience. experiment is that you can never say, this is Israel. You can never freeze the frame and say, now this is Israel. This is Israel now. But we've lived in Israel now for 35 years, which is half the life of the state. And we have experienced that I can think of at least three distinct different Israels in a period of 35
years. That is three.
We moved to Israel in 1982, in the summer of 82, which was the beginning of the first Lebanon War, when Israel is completely divided over war. Instead of war uniting Israel, it's dividing us. And then the first Intifada in the late 80s, Israeli society is bitterly divided, and Israel is isolated and alone. Then comes the 1990s. So that's one. That was the first Israel, the Israel of Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir. A very lonely Israel, almost no immigration. The Ethiopians were coming, but it was really a country that was being pushed off the map. Suddenly, the early 1990s, mass immigration, over a million Soviet immigrants coming, high-tech Israel is born, the Israel of the Oslo years, the international community discovering Israel, Israeli cuisine, Israeli music, it just becomes a world-class country. That's the second Israel. Then the next Israel is the Israel of the Second Intifada. And the Israel that I think we're still in, the Israel that begins with the collapse of the Oslo, the collapse of peace, the end of the dream of peace, which was another messianic dream, the new Middle East, as Shimon Peres used to call it. Well, look at the Middle East today. And the Israel that begins in the year 2000 with the exploding buses and the suicide bombings, is an Israel that I think exists to this day. And what began in the year 2000 is a new war. And that is the war against the Israeli home front. And the first 4 years of that war was 2000 to 2004, the suicide bombings in Israeli cities. Then we had a kind of a quiet period. 2006, Hezbollah launches its war of missiles on Israeli towns in the north, in the Galilee. And then thousands of rockets coming from Hamas in Gaza on Israeli communities for years along the Gaza border. And so that, for me, is one long war that begins in the year 2000, in which Israelis, civilian Israel, becomes the target more than military Israel. And this is a complete transformation of Israeli reality.
And let's come back now to Jerusalem, which is the theme of the whole festival. There is a very striking statement by one of your characters, I guess, or maybe by yourself, that Jerusalem, not so much Har HaBayit or anything specific, but Jerusalem as such unites or should unite the Jews all over the world. Do you think this is true?
It did for a very brief time. June 7th, 1967, the paratroopers reaching the wall, I think was the ultimate moment of Jewish unity. And Natan Sharansky has this wonderful passage in his autobiography, Fear No Evil, where he writes that he hears that the paratroopers have conquered the Temple Mount. And he says he feels so much pride, even though he didn't know what the Temple Mount was. And so I think that really, in some way, shows just how the most distant Jews, the supposedly lost Jews of the Soviet Union, were swept up into this moment of elation, of transcendence, on June 7th.
I think my recollection is very similar. You know, we were all not really. I had been to Israel before to visit our family, but
you had been before the 67 war.
Before 67, yes. But still, you know, I didn't know much, and I didn't feel the connection really. But in 67, yes, that was the moment where the emotion emotions were so high, and somehow we did feel the connection, and that something was happening. I wasn't able to call to name those emotions or those hopes, but there was something that, as I look at it this now, I would say of a messianic character. That's true. So. In this sense, yes, and the fact that it was Jerusalem rather than anything else was, of course, was of importance. Still, in Jerusalem is very important in many ways, and of course, it was the Jerusalem equals Zion equals the land of Israel, and so you know it was the focal point for generations. The question is whether Jerusalem, as it is now, is the uniting factor or divisive, or how is it?
You know, the Hartman Institute sits in an area called the German colony in Jerusalem. And if you look at about a square kilometer of the German colony, let's say beginning, those of you who know Jerusalem, beginning with the conservative movement center on Agron Street, and then around the corner on King David Street, you have Hebrew Union College, and then you keep going, you've got Kolot, Elul. These are all pluralistic Jewish institutions. Within a square kilometer in Jerusalem, you have the most creative centers of Jewish life outside the Orthodox world. And then Orthodox Jerusalem is certainly the most creative part of the Orthodox world. So spiritually, I think that Jerusalem has still managed to keep its place and even deepen. The liberal Jews who are serious about their Judaism may be very angry at Israel politically. They can't keep away from Jerusalem because that's become the source of their nourishment. And we see it at the Hartman Institute. Next week, we're going to have hundreds, literally hundreds of rabbis from the conservative and reform movements coming to the, and with a few Orthodox rabbis, brave Orthodox rabbis joining them, coming to the Hartman Institute to study together for 2 weeks. That doesn't happen anywhere. Doesn't happen in their communities. And so Jerusalem really has become the center of Jewish spiritual life. Now, the one of the dangers that I see is the rise of Haredi, of ultra-Orthodox political power in Jerusalem, which has the potential of driving away the other parts of the Jewish people. Now, we're experiencing this moment literally now over the wall. The decision, the government's decision a few days ago to rescind its own agreement because of ultra-Orthodox pressure. And we just had a week-long seminar at the Hartman Institute of North American lay leaders who came to study at Hartman for a week. And yesterday we had our closing panel, and we discussed this issue. How should North American Jews respond? And some people were saying, well, we should have a boycott of Israel for a year. We should pull out all of our philanthropy. No, we should have no birthright trips. And my response to them was, you should be doing exactly the opposite. You should be overwhelming Jerusalem with tens of thousands of Reform and conservative Jews and go as communities to the main plaza and pray in mixed prayer. Because if the ultra-Orthodox are going to stop you from praying in one part of the wall, say, okay, we're going to carry our prayer here into the main center. Now, in other words, do you withdraw from Jerusalem, or do these kinds of challenges force you to have an even stronger presence in Jerusalem? And I hope that we're heading in that direction. And it's going to be a very difficult fight, and an ugly fight, but it's a fight that we, I believe, the Jewish people cannot not have.
Thank you very much. Well, now maybe if there are questions or comments from the audience, this is the right moment. We don't have much time, but so please don't. Please try to be rather brief. Yes, please.
My name is Michael Thaler. Also from Polish background, Holocaust background. I made Aliyah before you, so I saw everything develop from 71 on. And your just statement about the reform and conservative, how do you expect a reform and conservative to have influence when, first of all, they have about 4%, they don't make Aliyah, so should they be heard? The next thing, 70% of the reform and conservative are intermarrying and assimilating, like you know. So why should they have, not that I agree with the ultra-Orthodox, but why should the reform have influence?
My answer to you is Zionism. And if, well, the question is, who does the state of Israel represent? What is the state of Israel? And my understanding of the state of Israel comes from the Declaration of Independence, which is our formative document, which has legal weight in Israel. And the Declaration of Independence, the framers of the Declaration regarded Israel as a Jewish state and a democratic state. My understanding of that is that Israel is the state of all Jews, is the homeland of all Jews, whether or not they are citizens of Israel, and it is the state of all of its citizens, whether or not they are Jews. And that's a very complicated maneuver, but that is one of the paradoxes of our identity. And if we're serious about being the homeland of the Jewish people, we are obliged to create a Jewish public space that in some way reflects something of the diversity of the Jewish people around the world. To create a public space in Israel which delegitimizes the religious expression of a majority of the Jewish people in the diaspora is, to my mind, an anti-Zionist act. And to surrender that public space to the ultra-Orthodox, who, for the most part today, are no longer militantly anti-Zionist as they once were, but certainly contributed very little to the creation and growth of the state, is, to my mind, a double offense. And so if we are serious about being the state that reflects the dream of Zionism, which is the dream of reconstituting the Jewish people, then we have no choice but to bring in a diaspora sensibility, whether or not they're citizens. Now, that doesn't mean that we're obligated to listen to American Jews who criticize us during wartime, or who criticize our defense policies or our settlement policies. Those are issues that will be resolved by us. But issues of Jewish identity that reflect on Jews around the world, I believe that Israel has every responsibility, if we are serious about being the homeland of the Jewish people, to reflect those concerns.
And let me add, you know, from our Polish perspective, that, you know, assimilation, of course, is a real phenomenon, and it can be dangerous, but it's not necessarily the last stage, the last chapter of those people who are involved. And because, you know, it seemed in Poland in the 1980s that there will be no more Jews, that, you know, all those old Jews who remember the pre-war times would disappear and that would be it. And it turned out that somehow there are Jews and there are new people who come and become more and more Jewish, having Jewish roots, and some without. And so it's the more complicated story, so we don't know how it will develop. But this really brings us to this general question, which I don't know if we have time to discuss it, the relations between Israel and the diaspora. So Yossi, in a way, answered part of the question, that Israel is like for all Jews in some way. But I also think, on the other hand, that diaspora is something that is the state of Israel does need. Do you agree?
Yeah, and I remember having that conversation with you in 1989 about the need for there to be some Jewish presence in Poland. And at the time, I was not convinced, and I am today. And it only enhances Israel and the Jewish people to recognize ourselves as a people that has always, we've always had home and diaspora, going back to Abraham, who came to the land of Israel and then left, and so this movement between Israel and diaspora is part of us being an Am Olam, which has a double meaning. It means both an eternal people, we are the people of eternity, and we're also Am Olam, the people of the world, people that live in all over the world.
Yes, I think. Okay, so there is another. Who wants? So there's one, and are there any other here? Okay, so two more questions, please.
I was interested that you spoke in terms of dreams of the collective Jewish / Israeli people, and I wondered about narratives and whether in our present generation the thing which is changing is this idea of the unitary grand narrative of Israeli society, of the kind that around which you based your book, that you've got a group of men who are involved in the army, very central to Israeli society, in a kind of event which is shaping the whole of society. And today, I think that we see much more in Israeli society a kind of a fragmentation. President Rivlin talked about the Shvatim, about Israeli society being divided into different tribes who rarely speak to each other. And at the same time, in the influence of feminism, postmodernism, and so on, different groups of people in Israeli society are simply taking their dreams, which are very heady dreams, but taking them into their own hands and not waiting for a single societal view, whether that's women becoming Orthodox rabbis in Jerusalem, whether it's young Arab citizens in Haifa creating alternative scenes and so on. So is this the era, perhaps, of many different dreams at the same time?
It's a very good way to put it, and it has potential and danger at the same time. The potential is that Israel is a society of ingathering. It's a society of Jews from almost 100 countries, along with the Arab Israelis. And so there's so much multiplicity in Israeli identity, so many levels of paradox. I'll be speaking about that in my talk tomorrow, of Israel as a society whose essence is paradox. That the only way to really honor the reality of Israeli society is to allow all of that diversity to be expressed. And in the early years of the state, under the Labour Party, under a certain vision of Israel as a secular, socialist, Ashkenazi-led society, the multiplicity of Israel was suppressed. In fact, even consciously suppressed. The Mizrahim, the Jews from Arab countries, were not given any real place in the culture. And so the Israel of today, when I said earlier that I think the Israel of today is much more pluralistic and frankly much more interesting than the Israel of the kibbutz and the 50s, and even though I love that Israel, I revere that Israel, but I would much prefer to live in this Israel today. And the reason for that is that we are now not just accepting, but in some way really celebrating the wild diversity of Israeli society. The danger is that we are a schismatic people. We are addicted to absolutism, and we see that in this the book the story that I tell in this book is partly a very sobering story about left and right refusing to listen to each other's insights. The left, from my point of view, the Israeli left was correct from beginning that occupying the Palestinian people is a disaster for Israel, and that we need to free ourselves from the occupation, and we need to save Israel as a Jewish majority and democratic state. So that's an argument that I think the Israeli left won. On the other side, the Israeli right won a crucial argument, which is that you can't make peace with a Palestinian national movement which denies the legitimacy, the indigenousness of the Jewish people in this land, in any part of this land. And so I think that most Israelis today are a mixture of left and right, in the sense that a majority of Israelis know we need to end the occupation, at the same time realize we don't have a credible peace partner on the other side to end the occupation. And that's really where we are. Now, the reason that I'm mentioning this is because what struck me in writing this story was how self-evident it was, to me at least, how both sides had a certain insight, a certain truth from the summer of 1967. You read the Israeli op-ed pages of the summer of 67, it's all laid out. Amos Oz writing about how the occupation is going to occupy us, and Nathan Alterman, the great Israeli poet, who was the founder of the Greater Israel movement, even though he was a man of the left, warning that if we create a state in the West Bank, it'll be a terrorist state. They were both right. And it was there from the beginning. And why did it take us 50 years for a majority of Israelis to get to the point to say, that's right, you know, the left understands the dangers of occupation and the right understands the delusion of a one-way peace process. That makes sense. But we are a people that each of our camps, or as you call it, the tribes, each tribe knows what it knows and believes that it is the custodian of authentic Jewish values, and that the other camps are somehow betraying Jewish values. So that's what we're seeing being played out over the wall. And we saw it being played out between left and right. So the great danger, what worries me in this release of our tribal instincts is a possible disintegration of whatever minimal cohesiveness Israeli society has.
Yes, thank you. Please.
Thank you very much for interesting meeting. You talked a lot about secular and religion country. Today's world is most secular, for example, countries in West Europe. Most of people continue their religion traditions. And what the situation looks like in Israeli society, and what are your arguments to present generation to continue their religion tradition, because religion had a huge value for Jews for many centuries. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. It's one of our most important questions. If you look at the Israeli polls in recent years, there are very interesting results. And a majority of Israelis seem to want two things. They want less religion and Judaism in our official institutions, and more Judaism and more tradition in our culture and in our schools and in our home, our family lives. So I think that what that really means is that we're starting to get serious about the future of Judaism in Israel. And we're not satisfied anymore with the symbols And we certainly, many of us, certainly do not want to have an all-controlling official rabbinate that dictates who can marry, how you can marry, when you can marry. And I see more of a move toward weakening the official power of religion in Israel, along with an awakening in Israeli society for a return to some form of tradition, along with creating new forms of Jewish observance. You know, I'll give you one example. This was about 2001, which was the height of the period we call the Second Intifada, you know, with the suicide bombings in Israel. And there was a big Israeli festival, a weekend of camping, and tens of thousands of Israelis were there, and a kind of a spiritual festival. And on Friday night, there was a band that played, and it played the song Shir HaMa'alot, one of the Psalms, and I lift my eyes to the mountains, from where will my help come? My help comes from God. And Sarah and I were there, and thousands of young Israelis in the audience. And many of these kids were on leave from their army units. They had come from Jenin and from Nablus, and really it was the worst time of the Second Intifada. And the singing along with that song that night was one of the most religious experiences that I've ever had. People were really praying. But if you would have asked anyone in that audience, is this a religious event? They would have said, of course not. This is a concert. It's Friday night. We're listening to music. It can't. How can this be religious? Because religious can only happen in an Orthodox setting. But I think that today attitudes are starting to change, and I think more and more Israelis would say, well, no, wait a minute. That actually is also Judaism. That's also religion, but that's how we do religion in the state of Israel. So I'm actually very optimistic about a spiritual transformation in Israeli society.
Thank you. Thank you. I think this is the right moment to end this meeting. So the book is like Dreamers, and our dreams are still there, and we are thankful to you, Yossi, for
thank you so much,
Stashek, for presenting our dreams. Thank you.